thanks Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus 580. Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program for the morning. My name is David Inge, and we are very glad to have you listening this morning. This first hour of the show, we'll be talking about prescription medication, and so this will be your opportunity to call in and ask questions. If you have questions about medicines that you're taking or someone in your family is taking, about how they work, about potential side effects, interactions with other medicines, those are the kind of things that we'll be doing here this morning. And our guest is Dr. James Rybacki. He has been with us before on this program to talk about this very topic and has been for a number of years now the author of a book entitled The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. And it has been updated annually. So the new version is out now, and it's the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs for 2004, which provides detailed profiles of hundreds of prescription medication. There are pictures here, so you can tell what they look like. And one of the things that has been added to the book over the last couple of years is the possibility of interactions between prescription medications and herbals that people may be taking, the kind of things that are available over the counter. So there's a lot of good information here. It's a good reference book, I think, to have on your shelf at home. So if you're interested, you can certainly go out and take a look at it. It's published by HarperCollins. James Rybacki is a member of the clinical faculty at University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. He is board certified in pain management by the American Academy of Pain Management. He's now president of the Clearwater Group, which provides drug information support and clinical pharmacy services to physician groups and consumers and employers. They also hold seminars on various topics, including medical cost containment, infectious disease, osteoporosis, pain management. He has been interviewed widely and has been a guest on many radio and television shows, and he has been good enough to spend some time with us this morning. Questions, of course, are welcome. The thing is, we just try to ask people to be brief in their questions so that we can get in as many people as possible and keep moving along. But, of course, anyone can call in. 333-9455. That's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Dr. Rybacki, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Yourself?
Back from New Jersey, not in the rain, and happy to be at my desk.
All right. Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. We're getting some calls lined up. I got a question by email from someone apparently who wouldn't be able to call in, so I guess I will ask their question right up front.
Great.
From someone who apparently was taking Lipitor, and the caller the listener says that they stopped taking it because they developed some muscle pain right as soon as they started taking it. And the question is it possible that they could still be suffering from this muscle pain even after several weeks of stopping the medication?
Interesting question, and a couple things. There's actually a combination medicine that's been approved that is one of the first that I'm aware of, which actually contains the generic, which is atorvastatin, along with a high blood pressure medicine called imlodipine. Our listeners can find that at www.fda.gov, and the new medicine is called Caduet, and it follows that sort of let's make it easier to remember to take medicines, and this one actually treats high blood pressure as well as high cholesterol. Now, the specific question and what that sort of gets at is possible side effects from medicines. And certainly if you look at any of the statin-type medicines, which is what this is, the technical name is an HMG-CoA reductase inhibitor. Whew, boy, that's a mouthful. But these can all have an effect on the muscles. The less severe effect is called a myositis. The more severe and very challenging one is rhabdomyolysis, where the muscles can actually be very, very severely damaged. And the question is, when you look at that, and this person, is there any more clarity in the sense of what happened? Was it muscle ache or any other laboratory studies helped?
I'm afraid I gave you all the information that I got.
In the absence of information, one of the things that can happen to help assess what's going on with the muscles themselves is a laboratory test called creatine kinase, a CK is the way you usually see it abbreviated, and that can be a way that that person's doctor can take a look at this and see how severe that reaction is. Now, there are a lot of different choices, and interestingly, the gentleman you have on the phone was taking one of those statin-type medicines and developed those sorts of muscle aches, felt like a real big pressure in the big muscles in the top of my legs. And when I went to my doctor, they got a CK and said, "Oh, Jim, you're going to have to stop this medicine." Now, I've transitioned over to a different statin-type medicine, and I'm tolerating that one very fine. So we got things right on track. But in general, when you look at muscle effects and when you look at a medicine in the body, write this down, 4.32 half-lives. If we round that up to 5, whatever the half-life of the medicine is, if you multiply that by 5, the medicine itself will be gone. You know, if there's damage from the medicine to the muscle, then his or her doctor would have to evaluate that to see, while the medicine's still gone, sort of an estimate on how long it might take for whatever damage to repair.
Okay. Well,
a great question, though.
I hope that that helps. Well, it gets toward, to what I'm sure is a very difficult question to answer when you have someone who begins taking some kind of medication and they have never taken it before, and immediately they start to experience something. And it seems to have been not, and it's anomalous. It wasn't there before, so I'm sure that the natural thing for them to assume is, well, this has something to do with this medicine that I just started taking because I didn't have the symptom before. I started taking the medicine. Now I have the symptom. Well, guilt by association. How do you go about sorting out whether something indeed is a side effect of a medication or it just happened to have happened at the same time?
That is brilliant. And if you've looked at the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, what you'll find is in the back in the glossary, correlation versus causation. And just because you've started a particular medicine and you have a particular symptom, there's what's called a differential diagnosis that your doctor is going to go through and try to figure out, well, okay, is this just something that happened at the same time, or can the medicine do this? Here, in the case of the statin-type medicines, very rare possible side effect, but myositis or polymyositis or the more severe rhabdomyolysis, muscle changes that are undesirable can happen in rare cases. So if there's that established amount of literature that says, yep, this is a known side effect, and here's what we need to do in looking at it, that's a great basis. Of course, if you look in the Essential Guide, you'll see that as a possible side effect under the statin-type medicines.
Mm-hmm. So that's something that people can do. They can look at this book. If they can get a hold of the package insert that goes with the medication, that also would list that. But I guess people also have to keep in mind that when that information includes every symptom that has ever been reported by anybody taking that medication.
Exactly. You know. And it gets back to that idea, oh, my gosh, look at those. Mm. But is the glass half full or half empty, and how probable a possible side effect? The other thing that you need to consider when looking in general at a possible side effect are all of the other medicines that that particular person may be taking, because as we know, there can be both prescription and non-prescription drug interactions, also herbal medicine drug interactions. They can actually, even though you're taking a normal dose, increase the effective amount of the medicine in the body that can lead to toxicity.
Well, I hope that that is something, some kind of an answer to the question for that listener. We do have a couple of people here who are ready to go who would like to talk with you.
It's also a great question. It's also Go Red Day for women in the sense of looking at national Wear Red Day for women and acknowledging the idea, if, I don't know if this was a male or a female, but the idea that heart disease is such a leading killer of women in our country. We need to do better about that. And of course, this medicine, which had an unfortunate side effect, is one of those great classes of medicines that helps lower cholesterol.
All right. Well, let's talk with some people who are
great,
listening here. We have a couple of Urbana callers, and we'll start with line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I'm an obsessive compulsive, and I take Celexa and Anafrinil, and I'm wondering if there are any new drugs that serve people who are obsessive compulsives.
Yeah, here's the first question. With that combination, for our listeners, what is actually being done is citalopram or Celexa is actually the serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And that tell me about the combination. Is that working well?
Yes, yes. I used to take just anafrenil, a high dose, and I had some side effects. So we lowered that and started the Celexa. And also there was depression, and the two seemed to work just fine for me.
And that's an interesting and very astute example of sometimes how combination therapy can allow one medicine to be lowered a little bit and another medicine to actually have a combination effect that's greater than the single one while avoiding the side effects of the higher doses. In general, looking at obsessive-compulsive disorder, that is not a field that I deal with very much at all. So the best thing would be to take a look at www.nimh.gov, the National Institute of Mental Health, and they'll have a latest treatment category there for you.
Okay. My second question is there a difference between SSRIs and SRIs?
Ah, interesting. When you look at that, this gets to how the medicines actually work. And if you look at the older medicines that were serotonin reuptake inhibitors, one of the theories in how depression happens is that we've all had, that sort of bad day. Well, you know, I've lost my job, and this is going to be very challenging for me. And that's sort of a reactive kind of depression. Some people who have normal amounts of transmitter, of the serotonin, if you will, wouldn't be sort of in that category where you'd be getting, I have a low amount of it, and that's why I'm depressed. The selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors are actually the second-generation antidepressants, if you will, that look at that specific serotonin itself, while some of the other ones actually look at norepinephrine and some other nerve transmitters. So they are different, and what you've got is two different classes. Great question.
Hey, thank you.
All right, let's go to line number two, and this is also Urbana. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
I have Tourette's syndrome.
Okay.
And the doctors have tried various medications, everything from Haldol to Klonopin. The thing I've been on for the longest is clonazepam.
Mm-hmm.
And I started off taking a half a milligram twice a day, and I have gotten up to 1 milligram three times a day as I've built up a tolerance to it. My biggest question is, I seem to be building up more of a tolerance to it, and I know the doctors are reluctant to go to a higher dosage.
I'm having a little trouble hearing you. Could you speak up just a little bit for me?
Sure, sure.
Okay. There we go. That's better.
I know the doctors are reluctant to go to a higher dosage of clonazepam than that. I'm curious what exactly causes my body to slowly build up a tolerance to that, and what do you do once you get to a point where your body has built up enough of a tolerance to medication that you can't take it anymore?
Interesting question. Here with Klonopin or clonazepam, it actually is removed from the body by the liver by an enzyme called cytochrome P450. And all that means is the body has a very specific enzyme that it uses to remove the body from the system. Now, are you actually seeing a decline in benefit from it? Help me with that a little bit.
Yes, I am seeing a gradual decline in benefit from it. So, yes, I am.
Okay. Interesting in that sense, too. When you look at how that happens, and it's a when you look at side effects versus benefits here, the data for that for clonazepam itself, and tell me the dose one more time.
I started off originally, it was half a milligram twice a day.
Okay.
By now, I'm up to 1 milligram three times a day.
Okay. In that sense, the way the doses are divided are tailored to both side effects and to benefits from the medicine itself. And the range that I'm familiar with in Tourette's itself can be about up to about 6 milligrams or so daily in a couple, divided into a couple doses. So the first, I think, answer is there's room in dosing, you know, still to adjust that. And in the sense of adding on a different medicine or what happens if you reach the higher dose there as well, that's something you need to bring back to your doctor about the current state of therapy and what can be added on if you reach it. But you've still got a long way to go.
Okay.
And congratulations on the result. Sounds like it's a good result.
Yeah, it's it's working out much better than everything else they've tried. And thank you, though. I've always been curious exactly how clonazepam gets out of me. So.
You betcha. Okay.
Well, very good. Thank you for the call. We have somebody next on a cell phone.
Those can be challenging.
Line number three. Hello.
Hi. I just want to make two comments. I want to respond to the woman who was asking about the OCD medication.
Oh, good.
In fact, Celexa is now the OCD medication of choice with the least side effects. That's the newest thing that's out there. And also I wanted to let people know who are treated for OCD, as I am, that they need to not just take one SSRI, and if it doesn't work, say, well, I guess it doesn't work. There's a tendency from doctors to talk about classes, and if a drug in a given class doesn't work, they don't go to another drug in the same class. So when they put me first on a really low dose of anaphronil, I went right through the ceiling. I was so up in the air, you know, sort of a caffeine thing.
Oh, boy, okay.
Then they gave me the lowest dose of Paxil, and I got the worst headaches I've ever had. And then they gave me a very high dose of Prozac, which just made me sleep for 14 hours.
That's not good.
Finally, what a person might do is to keep an eye. First of all, the Wall Street Journal is a very good place see what medicines are being used, and to find out particularly what's already being used in Europe and is in the American pipeline, because Europe lets you use the medications before the FDA will approve them for here. So that will let you, in fact, I went into my doctor, and I said, Celexa just got approved today. Could you get me stuff? And he said, oh, I didn't know it was approved yet, and he got it for me. So I wanted people to know that don't give up because one drug in a given class doesn't work. Talk to your doctor and go in, and you need to know. Doctors want intelligent patients, and they want you to give them information because they never have enough. And the other comment I was going to make very briefly is about 4 years ago I've been on an ACE inhibitor for about 15 years.
And that's an angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitor, usually for high blood pressure. Go ahead.
Right. And actually, I have a congestive heart failure.
Okay.
But what happened is they decided to give me a high dose because they were using it at the Barnes Hospital in St. Louis, which is a very big heart research center. And what happened is I lost all my taste completely. And if you looked it up in the PDR, it was listed as a side effect.
Yes.
But both my heart transplant doctor and my cardiologist and another cardiologist said they'd heard of it, but they'd never seen it in any cases they'd ever had. And they thought that was really strange. So they took me off the ACE inhibitor. And after a while, I still couldn't taste much. And I said, look, I really would rather live even if I can't taste things. So put me on a normal dose. And then I developed a really bad, weird, distorted taste. And they said, oh, that must still be the ACE inhibitor permanently destroyed whatever your receptors were. And now, after 4 years, finally my doctor said, you know, you have a lot of acid reflux. And maybe what we thought was a really bad taste that you get because of this medication you once took, you might be having something completely different, which is too much acid reflux that we're not able to treat.
And did you actually try something for the reflux?
Yeah, but, well, the thing is, nothing's worked well, and the only thing they can do is surgery, and because of my heart, no one will go in and do the fundoplication or the other operations. But they are switching me around to different brands of the proton pump inhibitors to see if one works better than another, because that's the thing. It's amazing when people will talk about a generic equivalent, particularly the HMOs, when not only aren't there generic equivalents, there aren't even equivalents within brand names, if you know what I mean.
Well, the challenge with that, I think, has a number of different factors. First of all, within any particular patient, looking medicine to medicine, you may have different effects or benefits and or side effects. There's something called pharmacogenomics, where looking at how you metabolize medicines and what particular receptors and those sorts of things, that's going to be a really burgeoning field, I think, where then therapy tailoring, picking a medicine within a class, can be a lot more science than as it is now. There can be a lot of changes that happen until you find the right one.
say. And if you take a lot of medicines, I mean, I'm just amazed that doctors are able to figure out what's causing what, because as you said, if you read the PDR, if actually following the PDR rules, I would conclude that taking aspirin is likely to cause pregnancy, because every woman I've ever met who was pregnant, you know, had to take aspirin. I'm going to say, well, that must be a causal situation going on. But when you're on, what did they say? If you're on more than four drugs, at least two of them are interacting in an unfavorable way.
Well, the interesting thing with that is there are probably some 50 million people in this country taking four or more drugs, and you have to be really circumspect and make sure that if you go see Dr. Smith, Dr. Jones, and then someone else, you have to say, gee, these are the other things that these people are taking, and then you have to go back and tell everyone else, hey, you know what? I've got this new prescription. What do you think? And, of course, talk to your pharmacist, look at the essential guide, get an objective, gee, are there possible drug interactions for this? And be a powerful patient. Go ahead and ask. It's okay.
I want to thank the caller for his comments and questions. I have some other people I want to get
Absolutely.
To. I want to ask that one sort of, just to pick up on his point, because let's say, for example, we're talking about acid reflux, which mm-hmm. is something, a problem a lot of people have. A few months ago, I know the American Academy of Gastroenterology put out a position paper looking at various aspects of treatment. And one of the things that the Academy said was, as far as they're concerned, proton pump inhibitors are all the same, and that what doctors should do is prescribe whichever one is cheapest for their patients, and that which sort of flies in the face of this notion that, as you articulated, and I think other doctors would, that in fact, if you have different medications within a particular class of medicines that are all supposed to do the same thing and chemically are supposed to be similar, that in fact one can work better for one person and another can work better for another person. Now, how do you try to figure out if you have, say, you know, three, four, or five choices of a medication that are supposed to be functionally equivalent, to find the right match between the medicine and the patient?
That's a big challenge. And when you look at that, going back to our first caller, if you look at citalopram, Celexa, that's a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, and that wasn't working. If you look at anafrenil, that's a tricyclic antidepressant, an older class medicine, and the combination, which was eventually arrived at, got a great result. If you look at a class of medicines that are all in the same family, I've used the essential guide, and where I group medicines together, I call it, for example, the angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor family. The first and I think limiting factor, unfortunately, may be the formulary, the list of medicines that your insurance company will pay for. And, of course, we know that's not always good medicine, and therapy needs to be individualized. So what your physician will do is look at that, and there are actually some programs that actually will point of service where you're in your doctor's office say, well, you know, Jim, your prescription plan will pay for this but not for that, and that may be where it started. Unfortunately, if you look at therapy over time, if you start developing a side effect, well, then your doctor may switch within the same class if it's something that needs to be treated, for example, in the proton pump inhibitors. And that process in individualizing therapy may involve varying doses, varying side effects or absence thereof, and changes in medicine. I guess two looks at that, that's great because there are options, and the individualized therapy, there's not really a great way at present to say this is the right one for you.
Well, let's get on to some other callers. Maybe I should also introduce again our guest. We're talking with Dr. James Rybacki. He's member of the clinical faculty at University of Maryland School of Pharmacy and is the author of The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs 2004. It's published by HarperCollins. This is a book that was first published in 1977, and he was the co-author for a number of years, and then since 1996, he's been assumed full authorship, and it has been updated annually, and it's a good reference book to consult. You might even want to have a copy on your shelf at home to read up on medicines that you or family members may be taking. And questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have a number of other people to talk with here. Next is Ivesdale and Line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
So, yes, I'm wondering about this drug of lithium. What are some of the really bad side effects? It's a 600 mg once a day, and it's been causing an upset stomach, and I'm kind of depressed with it. And I wondered if that just goes along with it or finally it'll kick in and do what it's supposed to do.
Well, let's talk about that first. Lithium actually is, well, we tend to think of it as a medicine. It's actually a chemical. It has a half-time rather than a half-life. And if you look at the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs on page 654, if we had one in front of us, as I do, what you'd see is there's a narrow range that this medicine is adjusted to.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're taking, did you start taking 600 milligrams?
Yes.
Okay. And has anybody gotten a blood level, sent you to a laboratory and taken some blood from you and taken a look at that yet?
Yes, they just did that yesterday.
Oh, that's a good thing. Okay. So for our listeners, what happens here, and with some other medicines for heart rhythms and some other medicines, anticoagulants, they're called narrow therapeutic window agents. And all that means is that we need to keep the level in a particular range. There's what's usually a minimally effective range and a maximum range where toxicity is more likely if you get above that. So how long have you been taking this?
2 weeks.
Okay. And if you don't mind, down here, what are we treating with this?
Depression and anxiety. I'm going to the U of I for a bachelor's degree. And, of course, I'm very, very busy studying and a lot of things going at the same time. So they gave it to me for antidepressants.
And have you had some changes in mood swings as well, too?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Because a lot of times what you see is where people have ongoing changes in mood, it can certainly be an antidepressant, also widely used as a mood stabilizer and what would be characterized as bipolar disorder. And some of the challenges in using this medicine well, and it sounds like they're right on top of it because they've gotten blood levels and have taken a look at it, there's a variety of different possible sorts of effects. Now, tell me a little bit more about what's going on with you. Are you going to the bathroom more often, or tell me about that?
No, just the upset stomach and throwing up, and I'm real depressed. So, but I think that's what they're giving it to me for.
Well, the challenge, and for our listeners, first of all, as far as nausea, vomiting, and,
uh-huh.
and diarrhea, that can go along with it to start.
Okay.
Some people get used to that. They accommodate to that over time once they've gotten used to the medicine. But that's something, if it continues, you need to talk to your doctors about and then ask about the dose and how that might work and tell them what you're experienced.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense of what can happen with swings in mood and
mm-hmm.
in true bipolar disorder, what can happen is you have a tremendous amount of energy and you really feel like you want to do the house and you want to go to school and you want to do everything else and take care of the car. Or it can be very challenging and you have minimal energy and very characteristic signs of depression. One of the things in talking with patients, exactly, and in talking with patients who have started this medicine, that feeling, and this is something you should express to your doctors as well, that, gee, I'm depressed now. That can be an adjustment to that feeling of avoiding the big amounts of energy, the mania in that part of bipolar disorder that you've gotten used to feeling. And it's sort of like being at a Porsche at a stoplight all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be part of what you're adjusting to that you're characterizing as depression. But you need to talk to your doctors about that one.
Yeah. Is it usually common, though, to make you sick to your stomach?
Well, any medicine has that sort of nausea, vomiting sort of effect because you're in there. You know, you're putting something in your body as well. Did they talk to you about taking it with food or those sorts of things?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And what are you doing in that sense?
Taking it with food.
Okay. And did that help? Did you do it all the time? Or?
Oh, it didn't help. It's still making me sick. So,
okay.
So,
when is that blood level going to come back?
Probably a couple of days, I thought they said. So,
are they going to call you or are you going to call them? How's that going to work?
I'm going to call them.
Okay. And it sounds like certainly since you're having that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
One of the questions, if there's actually a larger than expected amount in your system, maybe that sort of problem as well. But I think the two things, talk to your doctor about give him a call or her a call wherever you got the blood level taken and ask what it was, and then ask if longer term, if he or she thinks this is going to adjust in your particular body with your particular history, and ask about some other strategies to try to help that.
If you have too much lithium in your body,
right.
Is that can't be, can that be fatal?
Well, there's a very specific therapeutic range, and in that sense, a very high dose, yes, you could have seizures, those sorts of things. But if you've been taking the medicine as directed, and you know, if you look at one of the things I've done in the Essential Guide is actually to give ranges there, and of course, on the lab slip itself, they'll have specific ranges. Have you been taking it exactly as prescribed?
Yes, once a day.
Okay. Because usually what people aim for is about, this is a little technical, but about 0.6 to 1.2 millimoles per liter. And all that means is that they take some blood from you, and then they measure it in a machine, and then they try to keep it in that range.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's where, in general, most people get a desired clinical response.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. And have you tried it after meals? Rather than with food?
No, just usually with food.
Okay, do you know what? That may be another strategy. If you look at that, are you taking a prolonged action or an immediate release one? Do you remember?
I think it's a prolonged action.
Okay. The prolonged action ones, is it a capsule or a tablet?
Capsule.
A capsule, okay. The question, usually the prolonged actions are 300 or 450 milligrams. The capsules, 150, 300, and 600s are the immediate release. But one of the things you can try is to actually eat your meal first and then take the pill.
Okay.
That may make it a little bit easier on your system because there may not be enough food there to be avoiding some of that irritation.
Yeah.
So that may be a strategy to do it. And certainly talk to your doctor if that works and let them know what you've done, but adjusting it by that shorter amount of time shouldn't make a difference.
Yeah. So the blood count should make a difference. I mean, should tell me something, right?
Well, the blood level, if obviously you want to keep it in that what's called a therapeutic range, in what most people get a benefit from but avoid toxicity from, that's the first question. The second thing is to ask your doctor, well, if the blood level's in the higher end of that range, could some of what you're experiencing with a little feeling of nausea be from that? And then the question might be to lower the dose a little bit, but you need to adjust it by the level, and you need to know that information.
Okay.
All right?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's continue here, and our next caller should be on line number 2 and back in Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
You touched upon this earlier, but I was wondering, what's the maximum number of prescriptions someone can have before possible interactions, or, you know, you just can't understand what might happen? And I'm particularly concerned about the elderly who can't be their own advocate in a lot of cases.
The challenge and what a lot of people and a lot of people have written about is something called polypharmacy. And what you usually see tagged with that is, well, can the cure become the disease? And where you see some of these things happening is where people are seeing multiple physicians and there isn't real good follow-up and they just keep on adding different medicines. And, you know, when you start getting up in the 10s or 15s of medicines, I don't think there's an absolute number. And, of course, it depends on the medicines. But where you tend to see challenges with drug interactions are if you have, for example, a number of medicines using the same pathway to get out of the body. What we heard earlier in one of the callers was that their specific medicine in the liver was metabolized by an enzyme called cytochrome P450-3A4, and this is a common one. If you happen to have a couple of medicines that are using that same pathway to get out, they can overwhelm it a little bit, and that's where you can start getting into problems. The other thing you see in the elderly is that even if you don't have kidney disease, your kidneys get a little bit slower as time goes on. And what may be a normal dose in me at 49 may be a little bit too high a dose just because of the elimination if the medicine is removed by the kidney. So you always have to take that patient as they come and look at their kidneys and look at their livers. And as they start adding medicines on, consider how the medicines are removed by the body, if they may interact themselves, and if they may have pharmacologic effects that are actually the opposite of what you want. But it's a great question.
Does your book indicate what the pathway out might be?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It talks about how it's removed from the body and conditions requiring dosing instructions. And my publisher always complains about the exhaustive number of possible drug interactions that's in it, and I always try to keep that very, very current.
Okay, because the additional problem with my mother is she has, in all probability, a rarer form of dementia, and so she's very much affected by medications.
Boy, when you look at sensitivity to medicines themselves. Now, this dementia, is that characterized as Alzheimer's as well, or that a little bit?
It's probably Lewy body.
Okay. Okay. Boy, a little more complicated then, too.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Okay, well, you've given me something to consider. Thank you.
Now, one more thing to consider. Are you still there?
Yes.
Take
all the medicines, prescription, non-prescription, nutritional, that your mom may be taking, and give your pharmacy a call. See if they have what's called a brown bag session, or bring it in to whoever the internist is or family practice doc, whoever sees her most of the time, and ask that specific question. Hey, these are all the things that I'm taking. What do you think? Can any of them interact? And then ask the more specific question, could you run a drug interactions program on this and make sure?
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
Hey,
there you go. Let's go to Sycamore, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in knowing some of the side effects of Lanoxin. Now, I've been taking a quarter milligram once a day for about over three years now, and I've noticed some changes, and my ophthalmologist has noticed some changes in my retina that might possibly be associated with that. Do you have any information on that?
Yeah, when you look at, first of all, Lanoxin or digoxin is a medicine. It's in the essential guide to prescription drugs. And when you look at that, is this being used? Do you have congestive heart failure or do you have a heart problem? Help me with that a little bit.
All I'm taking it for is I had one episode of atrial fibrillation,
okay,
like about 3 years ago. And this is just being used as a preventative.
Okay. The question and with heart rhythm issues, Lanoxin is one of those medicines that can actually help the heart maintain its, and atrial fibrillation is an abnormal heart rhythm. And this can help maintain the normal rhythm of the heart, which is of course, something that we want to have happen. Usually what you see is digoxin in either congestive heart failure or supraventricular tachyarrhythmias, and they can be very helpful. Is the rhythm back to what's called a sinus rhythm? Is that
where
you are now?
It's been like that most of the time. I converted within a few hours of the onset, and my internist thought this might be useful as a preventative measure, and we have discussed getting off of it in the future. And I guess my bigger question to you is, since this is a known side effect, once I am off of it, will this reverse or will this stay this way?
Okay, the question of visual effects, ocular effects, if you will, is this, help me with what you're saying. Is it color vision? Is it intensity? Is it neuritis? How is that characterized to you?
There are a couple of areas off to the side of central vision that seem to have just experienced a change in color.
Okay, yeah, and disturbed color vision, especially yellow vision and halos around bright objects can do that. Any of the what are called cardiac glycosides can do that. There have also been some reports there of scotomas, floaters sort of things that can happen with that. And if you look at higher levels, it may or may not be associated with that, and a number of reports are possible with that. So, you know, in looking at that, the incidence with some of the digitalis toxicity, you may see those in as high as, you know, 95% or so. So, the first question going back to your doctor is, in the sense of atrial fibrillation, and actually you as well in patient empowerment, if you look at www.americanheart.org and patient profilers, there's actually a section there on arrhythmias, and I think there'll be a section for atrial fibrillation there. That'll help you bring evidence-based medicines and sort of the state of the art in what those are back to your doctors. You can have that really good informed discussion. And in the sense of your other question, in reversing them, that is not an area of expertise that I have. So you should ask their doctor that, in the sense of, okay, if we taper this medicine off, then how long would it be until any visual changes change? Great question, though.
Okay, very good. Thanks
right,
a lot.
Thank you. We have about 15 minutes left in this first hour of Focus 580.
We need two more hours.
I'm sure we could do this every month, probably.
This is fantastic.
I know you'd probably get tired of that, but...
No, I'm not sure I would. I might agree to commit to every other month, just because you have such interesting callers and interesting questions. My gosh.
Well, our guest is Dr. James Rybacki. He's a doctor of pharmacy. That's what his PhD is in. He's member of the clinical faculty at University of Maryland School of Pharmacy, and his book is The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs 2004. It has been coming out now for a number of years and gets an annual update. It's published by HarperCollins and is a good resource for people who have questions about medicines that they may be taking or people in their family. We do have a number of other callers, and
great,
we'll go on next to Champagne and line number three. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
You were talking before about how to select drugs, and my question is about a psychotropic drug, and you spoke about Celexa. And Celexa has recently, I think the patents come off, and the drug company has put out an isomer of the drug, which they're pushing. And so the insurance company has... or they don't cover Celexa like they used to, and they cover the new drug. And, you know, when getting on a psychotropic drug, like you talked about, that they don't all behave the same way, and one member of a family might work very well. And so I'm really reticent to change, and I wonder, you know, how often that comes up, and what can you do?
That's an interesting question, and when you look at what you're actually talking about, is that some companies actually will take that step if something's going off patent and look at a different isomer, an active structure, if you will. And the question, I think, and here's where I think we need some work on insurers and how we do that, is what's the benefit of the medicine for the patient, and if cost becomes a barrier to care, what are we going to do about that? You don't sound old enough to be eligible for Medicare, are you? Or
no.
Okay. But of course, what you want to do is to maintain the benefit you're getting from the citalopram or Celexa that you're previously taking. That, of course, can be a real challenge. When you look at that, have you looked at any of the... are you a veteran or anything like that?
No, okay. But the problem is it took... well over a year, maybe 2 years to get the right antidepressant.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've been on it for going on 3 years,
mm-hmm.
and I don't feel like going through the process again. So
gotcha. Sure.
I'm just sucking it up.
Well, the challenge, too, may be back to your doctor, if he or she knows any other sources, either community. There's actually a Table 21 on how to afford medicines in the Essential Guide.
Oh, okay.
And there are two things that I would actually say from that. There's a www.needymeds.com and www.rxassist.org, which are two websites you can go take a look at and see if there are some programs that you may not have thought of that may help you with that in affording the medicine and bridging that gap between what insurance is paying and what you're actually getting cost-shifted into and paying for, because you don't want to take the Lexapro or escitalopram, the newer isomer of the older drug.
Uh-huh.
That's a great question, but I would look in both those two places.
And then they may go generic, too, eventually.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you for the call, and we'll just keep going.
Okay.
Our next caller is, they must be listening on the Internet because they're in Gainesville, Florida.
Oh, okay.
This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Doctor, I'm taking several medications, and
okay.
I'm just wondering about the interaction between them. May I tell you what they are?
Well, if it's not an exhaustive list, one of the things that, and I would premise any question about drug interactions with, is the idea that wherever you're getting the medicines from, hopefully would have run a drug interactions check on it if you're getting it all from the same place. Secondly, if it hasn't been done, then I would certainly encourage you to do that. And then lastly, in the sense of drug interactions, there are not only drug-drug interactions or drug-disease interactions and some dosing questions that all come up with those. But having said all of that, go ahead and let's have a listen.
Okay. Lipitor.
Uh-huh.
Diltiazem.
Oh, wait. Say that again.
Diltiazem.
Oh, diltiazem. Okay, that's a calcium channel blocker. Lipitor, for our listeners, is atorvastatin, a medicine to lower cholesterol.
Wellbutrin.
Okay.
Atenolol. And Synthroid.
Okay. And how long have you been taking all of these?
I've just added Synthroid recently, but I've been taking the others for a while.
And you took all of these? Did you get them all from the same pharmacy?
Yes.
Okay. And then when the, excuse me, the Wellbutrin and Diltiazem were added on, was that all from the same pharmacy too?
Yes.
And are you having any adverse effects now at all?
No, but I started seeing floaters. And I don't know if there's any visual effects.
Boy, that's a... First of all, that's a very complicated regimen. And in the sense of looking at all of those over the phone, I'm concerned about being able to do a good job for you for that. What about the pharmacy itself? And talking to them about that combination. Have you done that?
Not yet, but I didn't know I could do that.
Sure. You know, give them a call and say, gee, have all these been screened for drug interactions? in the sense of what I would do would be to put these into a drug interactions checker and look at that and come up with levels of possible interactions for you. And in the sense of what I think we can accomplish on the phone, I think it's too complicated.
All right. Thanks, Doc.
You bet.
Thank you. Let's go to line two back here in Urbana. Hello.
Was that line two?
Yes.
My question is about eating grapefruit, which my husband and I dearly love. I take Nifedipin XL, and he takes Lipitor. Would it be possible to take it, you know, like eat grapefruit 12 hours from the time of taking it, or is it just strictly forbidden?
You know, that's a great question, and one that is actually a potential nutritional interaction when you look at that. And what happens is there are actually some compounds that are pharmacologically active that are in grapefruit to varying degrees. So the first question became, okay, how much grapefruit are you taking?
We're not having any now. And one of the directions says grapefruit juice, but, I mean, I think that means grapefruit.
Right, that's exactly right.
Uh-huh.
And it says not to take it with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that, and is that for your for the Lipitor? Tell me which drug.
Well, for both of these,
and help me with his medicine as well?
Lipitor,
right.
And Nifedipine.
Ah, the Nifedipine, okay. That particular calcium channel blocker, when you look at that as well, and you look at the enzyme that the way that the chemical that your body actually uses to remove that from the system, the way to think about this is that what potentially grapefruit juice on a regular basis does, and depending on how much enzyme or how reactive you are to the compound in the grapefruit juice, it can actually interfere with the enzyme itself. So even though you're taking a normal dose of both of those medicines, which are widely used,
mm-hmm.
You could get a toxic result. And, of course, when you think about that, that's not what you want to do. Mm-hmm. So what that interaction label is telling you is, well, it's probably better, since you're taking those medicines, not to combine them. And what I've seen as far as data is concerned is that the effect, even from that, you know, in 8 ounces of grapefruit juice, grapefruit itself, may last up to 3 days. So the 12-hour idea isn't going to work, so I wouldn't recommend it. Great question, though.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Well, you know, I think we're kind of coming to the point here we're going to have to finish. I'm really sorry we have a couple of callers that I don't think that we're going to be able to take, but in the interest of time, I think pretty much we're going to have to wrap it up with, however, the suggestion that if you have these kinds of questions, one place that you can go is to this book that we have been talking about here. The new version is out. It's The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs 2004. It has lots and lots of information on prescription medications and the kinds of things we've been talking about here, possible interactions, possible side effects. It's published by HarperCollins, and I think could be a good resource. So you can go out there and take a look at it. And also we want to say thanks to our guest, Dr. James Rybacki. He's member of the clinical faculty at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. And Dr. Rybacki, we just want to say thanks very, very much. We certainly appreciate it.
Oh, certainly my pleasure. And for all of our listeners, again, it is Go Red for Women Day. Take a look at that at www.americanheart.org. And also a new group, if you and your family members had a heart attack, www.mendedhearts.org. They're doing a lot of good work helping people understand how to live after a heart attack and get back on track.
All right. Very good. Well, our program here, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The broadcast is also made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. A little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn will be talking with dog trainer Jan Fennell. Her fans have nicknamed her the Dog Whisperer, and they'll be talking about communicating with dogs. She's the author of the dog training guide, The Dog Listener, and that will be following the 1 o'clock news here on AM 580. The show itself gets underway at noon with news. Also, Ed Kieser will have weather for you at 12:35, and in this segment that we call Talk to Ed, if you're going to be traveling over the next few days, he can tell you what the weather will be at your destination. So that's all as part of the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host, and that's coming up at noon. In our next hour, we'll actually be preempted so that we can bring you a special program that's being produced by Indiana Public Radio, and they're calling it Public Health in the Headlines. It is a live one-hour call-in show that will feature a number of guests, including Indiana's State Health Commissioner, Dr. Greg Wilson. People will be able to call in. Even if you live in Illinois, you can call in. They'll be talking about latest public health topics, bioterror, and so forth. So that'll be getting underway at 11 here on AM 580. But first, we have an update for you on the commodity markets, so stay with us.
Thank you very much, Dave, and good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. Looking at a higher market mostly across the board, except for in the wheat pit at the Chicago Board of Trade. Let's look at the specifics. March wheat at 379 and three quarters, down 1 1/4. May, 385 and a half, down 1 1/2. March corn, 278 and a half, up 3 1/4. July, 286 and a quarter, up 3 1/2. September, 281 and a half, up 3 1/2. December corn, 278, up 2. March soybeans, 841, up 8 3/4. The March contract as high as